This is the program about how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. Well, on today's program, we'll be looking at money in the 2016 elections. We'll be looking at the Buying the President series of reports done this year by the Center for Public Integrity. With us for the hour is politics reporter Michael Beckel, who co-authored several articles in the series published by the Center for Public Integrity. Michael joined the center as a politics reporter about 5 years ago, where his focus is on super PACs, politically active nonprofits, and the influence of money in elections. He previously worked for 3 years as the Money in Politics reporter for the Center for Responsive Politics. Beckel's exploits have taken him inside the U.S. Supreme Court multiple times, including the oral arguments on the landmark campaign finance cases, Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, and McCutcheon versus FEC, cases that regular listeners are familiar with. Earlier, he completed a year-long editorial fellowship with Mother Jones magazine, wrote for two alternative news weeklies in Colorado, and performed legislative research at Project Vote Smart. And he's a 2005 graduate of Colorado College. So let's have a look at the Buying the President series for 2016. Michael Beckel, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Thanks so much for having me this afternoon.
Yeah, we're so glad to have you on. We had a little trouble fighting the storm to get to you, but here you are. We really appreciate your being here with us. So there's a lot of money we're going to be talking about this afternoon, I think. How much money was in play during this election and all the candidates together? What kind of a scope do we have here now?
Well, billions of dollars were sloshing around in the 2016 election. When you add it all up, the White House race was a very high-profile race that attracted billions of dollars, and down-ballot races, so Senate races, House races, even state-level races, governors, state House, state Senate, all of these races added up to more than $6.9 billion. And in the presidential race alone, we calculated that about $2.17 billion was spent just by the candidates and the main groups like super PACs that were supporting them in the 2016 White House race. So it was a very expensive contest.
Wow, $2.7 billion.
I assume that's a record?
Well, it was interesting, the $7 billion, or that $6.7 billion figure that mm-hmm. the Center for Responsive Politics came up with mm-hmm. is definitely a record, the most expensive election cycle on record for the last 20 years that they've been calculating these types of figures. And over the 20 years, those numbers have just gone up and up and up. But in the presidential race, one of the very striking things was the amount of money that was spent on the presidential race alone went up slightly, but when you adjust it for inflation, it actually went down a little bit compared to the last couple races, in part because this was such an odd election year where the major candidate for one of the two major parties wasn't doing a lot of the traditional fundraising, wasn't buying a lot of the traditional TV ads, and so you had Hillary Clinton's campaign using a full host of different tools to raise money and have her message getting out to voters, and Donald Trump was instead relying a lot on his celebrity, on his tweets, on his earned media by other news outlets picking up what he was saying, and wasn't spending as much on ads himself as some of the other recent Republican nominees had. So it made for a very interesting dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess the whole media scene has changed. I know Van Jones had commented that Kennedy won over Nixon because of television, and of course FDR won because of radio, and Obama won because of social media, and now we have a whole new thing, which is reality TV plus Twitter.
Yeah, it's an evolving process. We know that modern campaigns are expensive endeavors. People want to make sure they have enough money to do all the things that they want to do. They want to buy TV ads and radio ads and digital ads. They want to have door knockers in the battleground states. You know, they want to have people making those phone calls and knocking on doors. And all those things take a lot of money, and you want to have more money than less, typically, to be able to play in all the different battleground states. And that is one reason that we see that these expensive races just keep getting more and more expensive.
So that was the big jump this year, or last year now, in down-ballot spending then? Was that up significantly, do we know, versus previous years?
Yeah, that's right. We saw an uptick in the spending in House and Senate races in particular, where a lot of money that maybe traditionally would have been spent at the presidential level was pumped into these high-profile House and Senate races, with a lot of Republican money wanting to be moved into these races where they wanted to maintain majorities in the House and Senate, be able to say they weren't sure exactly how the Trump situation was going to play out, but they knew that they could put those extra bucks into down-ballot races. And ultimately, they were able to win not only the presidency, but control of both chambers of Congress as well in November.
Ouch.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. So do you see this as a trend now? I mean, is this the way it's going to be from now on?
Well, every presidential election is different. There will be a lot of unique aspects to what made Donald Trump successful this time around, and there was a lot of things that made Hillary Clinton a unique candidate this time around as well. We talk a little bit about the types of fundraising that she was doing. You know, she, unlike Obama, very fully embraced super PACs as a fundraising vehicle. She was raising money for her traditional campaign committee, which was limited in how much money each individual donor could give, but she early on had given a blessing to a super PAC that was out there raising tens of millions of dollars on her behalf as well from a lot of liberal billionaires and other wealthy Democrats who wanted to make sure that she was the next president, that she could break the glass ceiling and be elected the first woman president of the United States. And one thing that she capitalized on a lot throughout that campaign was that status, and she was able to raise more money from women than a lot of other politicians have. So I think there are certain trends and certain tools that both sides of the aisles will be building on in the elections ahead. I mean, everything sort of starts at the presidential level, where you experiment, you make different choices, you try to figure out how these big money tools and these strategies and these techniques for fundraising are going to work. And eventually they trickle down to the down ballot races, to the Senate races, to the House state races, to the gubernatorial races, and eventually other state level races. And so a lot of this is trickle down, starting with a lot of innovation at the presidential level. Just like 8 years ago, there was a lot of innovation with the way Barack Obama was running his campaign, the types of fundraising and getting small donors to raise money online in new ways, getting those people hooked, wanting to raise money over and over and over again with these small dollar increment donations. And you saw candidates on both the right and the left try to tap into that mentality this year, or this election as well, with Bernie Sanders really standing head and shoulders above the rest of the field, being able to raise hundreds of millions of dollars, in large part because people were giving, you know, that $27 at a time that he made so famous in his stump speeches.
Yeah, that's one thing we're really interested in. So what were some of the strategies that Sanders was able to use? So Trump, I guess, was using his reality TV and Twitter. He just bypassed the whole system. And Clinton, who said that she would undo Citizens United when she was elected, if she were elected, was really taking, as she said, all this building up the PAC money. So how did Sanders do what he did? He took the third road.
Yeah, one of the things that made Sanders unique was that he was not a traditional Democrat. He was an independent who decided to run as a Democrat and based a lot of his arguments around special interests and the billionaire class as a whole. So he wanted to be funded by grassroots donors. He wanted to be funded by the people, not the billionaires. And so when you look at a lot of the different avenues that any politician has available to them, they're trying to build a brand and they're trying to build a unique selling point for themselves to be able to motivate people to give. And sometimes they're doing that reaching out to grassroots donors with regular fundraising emails. I'm sure many of the people listening today in California got those types of emails sometimes 3, 4, 5, 6 times a day from candidates trying to get them to give $3 at a time or $5 at a time or $27 at a time. And that's one way that politicians are looking to build more and more support. One of the very traditional means of fundraising is having these large dollar donor events where you pay whatever, maybe $1,000, $2,000. The legal limit right now during the past election was $2,700 per election. So you could have these ticketed events where donors would get to mingle. They'd be able to maybe hear the candidate speak. And Bernie Sanders railed against the billionaires being able to buy elections. So he was really trying to stand out in a way that was very different from a lot of other candidates. We saw Donald Trump trying to stand out as well during the GOP primary, especially when he was on those debate stages. He was talking about how he knew the system inside and out because he had been a creature of the system, that he had bought politicians, that he had written checks to Democrats, he had written checks to Republicans, and he was now above it all because he was too rich to be bought. And we know, despite all his rhetoric about trying to drain the swamp, that the devil is in the details, and he is now relying on a lot of structures and people who are very much creatures of this system as well. And so it remains to be seen entirely how all of that rhetoric is going to hit the road. But I do think there are going to be candidates trying to emulate those outsider tactics and strategies because that resonated with a lot of voters this past election cycle.
Well, we'll see how that portends for the future and see shortly how his nominees do and whoever finally gets appointed to the different positions in his cabinet. But back to Sanders. So I didn't see a final number for how much he raised versus Clinton and Trump. So is that something you can tell us, rough figures?
At the end of the day, Bernie Sanders raised about $237 million. And, of course, he was only raising money for that primary election period. So both mm-hmm. Trump and Clinton got to raise money for their primary and general elections account. Yeah. So Bernie Sanders is at about $237 million, and Trump's campaign was about $339 million for both the primary and the general election.
Mm-hmm.
And then the number one in terms of campaign cash was Hillary Clinton, and she raised... Her campaign itself raised about $580 million. So that doesn't, none of those figures include any super PACs or any supportive groups. That was just money going straight into the campaign.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's pretty astounding. Yeah, she was really at it, and she was the one who was going to undo Citizens United, I guess. One of the things that we were wondering if you could say a little bit more, I know we do always get these things. Well, I'm going to raise a lot of money from a lot of donors paying small amounts. But did he have some special strategy to make that work? Was it just the force of his message?
I'm sure it was a number of factors that contributed to that. Being able to tap into that sentiment was a huge part of it, and being able to have the tools and the platform and the fundraising strategies around that help people feel motivated, help people feel like they have skin in the game. And so if they're able to give a lot or give a little a lot of times because they feel like Bernie really was going to need their money to compete in the next primary. And so you saw those kind of flashpoints during the primary being moments when, you know, whoever won a particular primary wanted to capitalize on their win and be able to say, we need more money to be able to compete in the next battleground state. So he had a lot of people employed on his digital team, on his fundraising team, trying to motivate people to make those small incremental donations. And, you know, at one point in the election, more than half of his money was coming from people who were giving $200 or less. And that was just a really astonishing stat when we talk about how much money Obama raised back in the 2008 election cycle. People were getting really excited when he was raising about maybe a third of his money, 33% of his money from these small dollar donors giving $200 or less. And again, some of those people you're able to convert into people who donate and eventually hit that $200 level and give more and more. And that's a significant level for the disclosure threshold. It's a sort of arbitrary line in the sand, but at $200, any amount that you give exceeding $200, your name and the date of the contribution and that sort of itemized information gets reported to the Federal Election Commission. So if you give $200 or if you give $2,700, reporters like me are able to track and look for patterns and see what industries are giving, see what types of, you know, people are giving at an itemized level. But if you give less than that, there's just an aggregate amount. And so over and over and over again, Bernie stood out as a candidate who is raising a lot of money from people giving a very small dollar amount in the campaign. And I think that was sort of a very unique mix of factors that contributed to that.
Do we happen to know the statistic for Clinton's campaign for the small donors like this versus the major donors?
Well, again, I think it was closer to that 20 to 30%. It was something that, they were able to, at various points in the time, get a lot of people to buy in. You know, cinching the Democratic nomination attracted some new donors. Mm-hmm. Being able to contrast herself against Trump attracted donors. At one point, they were sort of asking people to donate $3 or some small dollar amount and get your own woman card, because that was a talking point at one point in the campaign. And so you see these types of fundraising gimmicks, and that is often one way that people end up becoming campaign contributors. Maybe they wanted a woman card, or maybe they wanted a Christmas ornament, or maybe they wanted a t-shirt. All that type of merchandise also feeds the campaign war chest.
Yeah, I can. I still want to get a Bernie action doll myself. I know that Trump has said that, well, he's already rich, so he's above it all, but he actually merchandised himself in this election on a level of tackiness I don't remember ever seeing, with his daughter wanting to sell her diamond bracelet, and he wanted to sell a hunting trip with his son for $1 million, and a private dinner with him for $1 million here, $1 million there.
I never saw an ad for a Trump toupee, but
there you go. You're a marketing genius, Steve.
This is maybe a small tangent. Any comment on Jill Stein and the Green Party and their donations and such?
Well, we certainly saw the Green Party candidate and Libertarian candidate, Jill Stein and Gary Johnson, respectively, do much better than previous candidates had done in a lot of different states, a lot of different jurisdictions. They were winning a substantial amount of votes, and they raised a fair sum of money at the end of the day, clearly not in the same ballpark as a Donald Trump or a Hillary Clinton. And Gary Johnson raised about $11.5 million for his campaign over the course of the election. He also had a handful of super PACs helping him to the tune of about $4 million. And Jill Stein, for the general election period, raised about $3.7 million. And she did not have any super PACs in her quarter. There weren't any big Green Party billionaires giving money to her group. She was also more of a people-powered campaign. And, you know, it's striking, after the election, of course, she put forward this proposal for recounts in some of the top battleground states, and she actually raised more money for the recount effort than she had for her campaign prior to the election.
Bless her heart.
Almost twice as much money.
Yeah, thanks for confirming that. That was the next question going to come out of my mouth. So you beat me to it there, and that's quite impressive. And that was all, that was all populist small donations, as far as I know. Is that something you can confirm?
Yeah, it was also money that was raised under the federal limits. So some of those were small dollar donations in the, you know, $20 or $100 scale. Some of that money was coming from people who were giving $200 or more. We sort of poked around and looked at some of the people who were making $2,700 donations to the recount effort, that mm-hmm. type of thing. But she raised, through the end of November, according to the most recent campaign finance report, she had raised about $1.4 million from people who gave somewhere between $200 and $2,700 for the recount, and about $4.4 million from the people who were giving less than $200. So yes, that recount effort was overwhelmingly funded by people making small dollar donations.
That's very striking. That's greater than a 3-to-1 ratio in small donors versus large. But large here is just a few hundred dollars versus, you know, 25 to 50 or something like that.
Right.
Quite striking to me.
Yeah, and I guess it tells us that people really do want to have their votes counted. She did so well on that aspect of it.
One little tangent there, and that money goes to some special fund I read in one article. So it doesn't go to Jill Stein, and it can't be used for any Green Party thing, such, right? It's there's some other special way that's accounted for. Is that something you're familiar with?
Yeah. So the candidate herself in this case was taking that money to pay it toward the recount costs in the various states. So in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, she was saying she needed to raise X million to pay for the legal fight or to pay for the filing fees. And she made some of these transfers, and people could follow the money. You know, all of this gets disclosed thanks to these reports that get filed with the Federal Election Commission. And so the candidate, whether it was the recount fund or any campaign contribution that gets made, candidates are not allowed to use the money they raise for personal use. Mm-hmm. They can't just pocket the money. They can't use it on personal expenses. It has to be, a legitimate campaign expense, and there's some latitude and, in that, certainly, if you're a presidential candidate, you're going to be doing a lot of travel, and, it's your discretion to stay at, the Ritz-Carlton versus the Motel 6, but I mean,
not
it's all
Tower.
Part of...
Sorry, go ahead. Not the Trump Tower, I said.
Yeah. It's all part of, what we are able to track thanks to the public disclosure system. Mm-hmm. You can see exactly what hotels are being stayed at or what airlines are being flown. You don't necessarily know if they're flying coach or business class or first class or anything like that, but you are able to follow the money thanks to the reports that get filed with the Federal Election Commission.
Okay, and then she collected, I think, more than was spent for the recall? Does that sound? Because some of it was refunded. One of the states had to refund money to her because they didn't follow through.
That's right. And so then, she's taking steps to, refund some of that money or figure out, I think she put toward the supporters how they wanted to donate that money to a charity that would support, some of these voting right issues or issues that were near and dear to her heart and the heart of the, debate about democracy in the country. So, anytime a candidate has extra money, they have a certain amount of discretion about how it gets spent. So whether it's Jill Stein or Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, of course, Donald Trump might keep his money in the bank and, use it for his reelection bid in 4 years. But any candidate, can decide if they maybe want to donate some of the money to charity or donate it to a state party or a national party or other candidates that are allies or they want to be supportive of. Again, the bottom line is a candidate isn't able to use the money for personal use.
Speaking of returning money, I guess Clinton had to return some of the money she got. You said she was pushing some legal boundaries?
Well, there were a number of groups that were active supporting both Clinton and Trump, and a number of donors who made donations to both Clinton and Trump. And we were following the money on both of those veins going into it. And so one of the things that we observed and wrote about in our Buying of the President series on publicintegrity.org was the fact that there were pro-Clinton groups that were getting some money. There was a super PAC in particular that had gotten money from a company that was a federal contractor, and then later a separate Democratic super PAC that had got money from the foundation associated with that company. And any 501c3 charity is not allowed to make a political donation. So if you are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, you can't donate to a candidate, you can't donate to a super PAC, and that was one of the situations that we found where a six-figure donation had been made to a pro-Clinton super PAC, and that foundation then had to, you know, ask for the money back. The super PAC disgorged that money, gave it back to the donor, but we also found cases of individual donors from time to time making small excessive contributions, and the FEC regularly flags those types of things. And one of the most notable illegal contributions we found was a foreign national who was actually living in Canada who donated to Donald Trump. And this wasn't just any Canadian, but he was a young millennial who was, according to his Twitter profile, a proud Muslim, and he had made a bet with some of his friends in Canada that they were going to meet certain workout goals, and then when one of his friends failed to meet that goal, they had to donate, according to the terms of the bet that they had made with themselves, to something that, you know, they were not actually in support of. They were trying to use this as an anti-charity. As motivation. And so, you know, we were sorting through campaign finance filings one day and looking at some of the different donations that had come in from overseas donors and donors living abroad, because, of course, American donors living abroad are legally allowed to donate, but foreign nationals are not. And so we started digging into this. And, you know, this was a small, you know, I think they had wagered $300 Canadian dollars and converted it into American dollars to make the donation. And, you know, we flagged it, and the Trump campaign immediately refunded it. And so these types of things come up from time to time on both sides. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, you've got a team helping you comply with the campaign finance laws, making sure you don't take money from prohibited sources. But from time to time, you might see a small donation, like this young man in Toronto who had made this contribution, or you might see a six-figure contribution from a company like this government contractor and its foundation that had donated to these pro-Clinton super PACs. And so that's why we think following the money is so important, to be able to make those connections and point those things out. And at the same time, I think to your question, both of the candidates are experimenting with these vehicles and the way that the campaign finance rules have changed over the years. And so one of the big Supreme Court cases in the last couple of years was this McCutcheon v. FEC decision, which allowed the, I guess, original campaign contribution limits had an aggregate limit of how much you could give in mass. So you couldn't give more than X amount over a course of a two-year cycle, and the Supreme Court knocked that down in McCutcheon. And so these base limits still exist. You can't give more than $2,700 to a candidate. You can't give more than the limit to the state party or the national party or any of these traditional PACs. But what we saw out of that decision was an emergence of almost mega joint fundraising committees. So these joint fundraising groups that previously were impacted by the aggregate limit no longer had any limit. So the gloves really came off, and people could give six-figure donations to these groups. And the Hillary Victory Fund as the pro-Clinton big joint fundraising group was called, was really pushing the limits in terms of not just embracing this decision and fundraising under the legal guidance that came out of that decision, but how they were spending that money. So some of the rules say that they can transfer that money back to the candidates and back to the state parties who are participating in the Victory Fund in this joint fundraising group, but they were also spending tens of millions of dollars on advertisements that looked a lot like campaign ads.
Mm-hmm.
But in the final couple of seconds, you watch that online video, and there's a little message that pops up and says, make a donation. And thanks to that little message at the end, they were arguing that this was a allowable campaign expenditure because it was related to the fundraising expenses rather than a independent expenditure or rather than a campaign advertisement, any of these things that essentially a viewer out there might watch the same two ads and except for that final couple of seconds, they would look indistinguishable, but one of them was paid for by donations no more than $2,700, and the other one could have been paid for with donations up to six figures. Some of the max donations to that group were closer to $770,000 that these people were able to give, and then that money, you know, eventually trickled down to the Clinton campaign, the DNC, the state parties in about 38 states that were participating in it. But the group itself was really taking a new step forward in how it was running so many of these ads itself and not just giving the money to one of its benefactors who would in turn run ads.
Okay. Let me take a moment to remind listeners, you're listening to Corporations and Democracy. Our topic today is a series about money in the elections put out by the Center for Public Integrity. It's called Buying the President, and our guest is a politics reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, Michael Beckel. If you would like to join the conversation, since it is now, this program's going quickly, about 12 to the hour. Our number here is 895-2448 in area code 707. If you have any questions for our guest, again, 895-2448.
One of the things that I thought was pretty interesting that you mentioned you found is that almost all journalists donated to the Clinton campaign, and that perhaps that's why Trump calls journalists scum. Do you want to comment on that whole
sure,
sector of the economy?
One of the investigations we did was looking at people who self-identified as journalists or reporters. So I think an important caveat to note is that most journalists don't make political contributions. Most political reporters don't make campaign contributions. Most reporters who are working at major news organizations have some sort of ethics policy. There could be internal rules that prohibit them from making campaign contributions. And so we were really looking at the exceptions to that rule and the fact that some news organizations didn't have clear policies in place. And at the end of the day, according to our analysis, of the donations that were tracked to reporters, and we're talking about maybe $400,000 in the scheme of things, about 96% of that money flowed to Clinton and only about 4% flowed to Trump. So of the reporters who were given, they were overwhelmingly favoring Democrat Hillary Clinton, and that was something that resonated a lot with the Trump campaign, resonated a lot with him feeling under attack by the media, and at the end of the day, they were making a very strong case how they felt they were, being covered by the media, even by media who weren't necessarily making political contributions to them. So there's been a very antagonistic relationship between Trump and the press throughout the entire campaign.
Do you want to talk more about other, sectors of groups that, who were Trump's super donors? Where was the different kinds of money going?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the analyses that we authored last month was looking at all of his big mega donors, and of course Donald Trump himself was his own biggest mega donor. He contributed about $66 million of his own funds to his campaign, but there were 18 ultra-wealthy Americans who also contributed at least $1 million to efforts to help elect him president. And some of those names might be names that sound familiar to listeners, such as casino magnate Sheldon Adelson and his wife Miriam Adelson of Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. You've got former WWE executive Linda McMahon, who is now slated to serve in Trump's cabinet, having been nominated to head the Small Business Administration. She donated about $6.2 million to various Trump super PACs and groups that were helping, trying to elect him. Diane Hendricks, who is a businesswoman in Wisconsin, who is actually the wealthiest woman in Wisconsin, had funded a group that was running pro-Trump ads and anti-Clinton ads in her home state of Wisconsin. And, you know, she had pumped millions of dollars into that effort. The owner of the Houston Texans, Robert McNair, is another Trump super donor, having given about $2.4 million to different Trump efforts. Peter Thiel, the Silicon Valley visionary, has given about $1.3 million to different Trump groups. And so there's a eclectic mix of folks who ultimately got in on the bottom floor supporting Trump's efforts early on and throughout the fall when it became clear that he was the Republican nominee. And Trump himself had largely self-financed his primary run, but in the general election, he was able to get as far as he was, in part because there was a network of groups that was going to bat for him. And even in addition to some of the pro-Trump super PACs, we know that there were groups like the National Rifle Association, for instance, that had spent about $30 million on ads. And so you see that in presidential elections where you've got these groups that are ideologically motivated playing a large role as well. And at the end of the day, the NRA spent about $30 million to help elect Trump. And they, I think, are going to be hoping that he does certain things and certainly takes very different stances on the Second Amendment than Hillary Clinton would have.
So we got the journalists for Clinton and the techie companies for Trump. There's some real clear delineations here.
Actually, wasn't that fella from tech company donor? Wasn't that relatively out of step for the mainstream of Silicon Valley and high tech?
Yeah, that's right, Steve. The I would say the prevalence within the tech community was really lined up behind Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. If you look at some of the other tech companies, Peter Thiel is known for, I think, his libertarian-leaning views, and that put him much more out of step with a lot of the other people. So you had billionaire Facebook co-founder Dustin Moskovitz, who was donating to Hillary Clinton. You had billionaire Napster co-founder Sean Parker donating to Hillary Clinton. You had Sheryl Sandberg, the chief operating officer of Facebook, and another billionaire donating to Hillary Clinton. And so a lot of Silicon Valley bigwigs and Silicon Valley employees were actually donating to the Democrat. One analysis that we did looked at just the employees at Google and Facebook and Amazon, and they gave about $2.4 million combined to Hillary's presidential campaign and only about $36,000 or so to Trump's campaign. So I think it was sort of a hodgepodge of people who made that Trump super donor list, in part because when we looked at the data, it was a lot of retirees, a lot of self-described businessmen or small business owners were some of Trump's largest donors overall. There wasn't some of that same industry support that you saw writ large lining up behind Hillary as much.
Yeah, well, thank you for stopping me from defaming the tech industry and clearing that up. We're getting close to the end of our time here, so I was wondering if we should spend a little bit of time on the Center for Public Integrity that you work for. Who are they? What do you do?
That's great. We are a nonpartisan, nonprofit news organization, and our bread and butter is investigative reporting. We publish everything we do on publicintegrity.org. That's our website. And we are based just a few blocks from the White House in Washington, D.C. We're the only nonprofit news organization of our scale based here in Washington, D.C. There's a couple peer organizations that listeners might have heard of, such as ProPublica based in New York, or the Center for Investigative Reporting and the Reveal podcast based in California. But we're just blocks from the White House, and we've been doing this for over 26 years, 27 years. We were founded in 1989, and we serve to be a watchdog in the corridor of power, and we've got teams who are following the money in politics at the federal level, at the state level. We've also got folks investigating environmental issues and health issues, national security issues, and waste, fraud, abuse within that arena. And so we've got a lot of different investigations that we publish, and we invite people to check our work out on our website at publicintegrity.org.
I'm going to interrupt us for just a moment to let listeners know that at the top of the hour, we're going to be going to Roots and All with Jeff in the Mendocino studio. But first, Rich and the KZWX new team will come in and update everybody on the god-awful roads and weather conditions around here. Meanwhile, back to our guest, Michael Beckel. We're just wrapping up here and talking a little bit about the Center for Public Integrity. And indeed, your center has won a Pulitzer Prize, right? And a lot of notoriety for publishing or finding out about the Panama Papers. Do you want to just touch on that?
Yeah, that's right. We also have an international arm of our organization called the ICIJ and the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and they worked with a newspaper in Germany to bring the Panama Papers project to light last year, working with hundreds of reporters across the globe, being able to do a simultaneous investigation that has really had impacts across the globe in various countries. And that's what we do. At the end of the day, we are an organization that focuses on investigative reporting. And one of my colleagues in 2014 won the Pulitzer Prize for a series that he wrote that chronicled the resurgence of black lung disease and the legal hurdles that miners were facing trying to get those benefits that were owed to them. And so there's a lot of really powerful work and a lot of really deep dive investigations that we're trying to do. And it's a very important time to be working as an investigative reporter.
Yes, it is. And what we've been working from this afternoon is something that you released called Buying of the President 2016. And we just let you just comment just for, like a half a sentence on that, and then we're going to take off and get our listeners informed.
Well, that was our project that was tracking all of the money flowing into the presidential election in 2016. And we follow the money on both sides of the aisle without fear or favor, trying to track where the money is going and who ultimately is seeking access and favors for those types of donations.
Okay, thank you so much, Michael Beckel.
Yes, and by the way, the Reveal program does run on our station here also. My compliments on it. It's a regular interest to me, and I sure enjoy it.